Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, could state trust land hold the key for solving two of Arizona's biggest issues? And Chinese food is a popular meal on Christmas, but if you want to eat it, plan ahead. But first, as the end of the year approaches, we're taking some time here on the show to talk about some of the biggest issues facing the state and how the debates about them are shaping up for 2026. Today's topic, education. For a look ahead on the most pressing questions facing parents, students, educators, and legislators, my co-host Sam Dingman sat down with two policy advocates who are both veterans of state government, Rebecca Beebe, Director of Government Relations for the Arizona School Administrators, and Carla Phillips-Kravikas, co-founder of Champions for Kids.
I wanted to start by asking you each to share an anecdote, a moment you've had, whether it's talking to a parent or a student or a conversation with somebody with whom you regularly converse about education issues, but an anecdote that has stuck with you and is driving your thinking these days. Rebecca, let's start with you.
Sure. So what came to mind immediately are two recent conversations I've had with two people in my life that I'm very close to who are both moms of children in elementary school. These were separate conversations, but both of them kind of told me that their children were struggling with reading, and one's in third grade and one's in fourth grade. And I kind of freaked out a little bit, and I said, are you just now finding out? Like, you should know this. There's interventions at the school. And, you know, for whatever reason, neither of those people had told me about this until their children were older. But they said, oh, yeah, of course. You know, I was getting in for, you know, the school in kindergarten identified my daughter as having issues with reading. And so we were talking about the interventions that the school was doing and how the school had reached out. And frankly, I thought of all the kids who now in Arizona are outside the public school system, whose parents may not know, you know, that literacy issues with the child's literacy show up in kindergarten, as young as five and even younger. Mm-hmm. And what are those children's literacy skills and how are they potentially not having their needs met? And so I've just been thinking about that a lot.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll come back to literacy later in the conversation. Carla, how about you? Same question.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I can affirm that story nine times over of the stories I hear. But the one that came to my mind immediately, because it's been just burning in my heart, I got a call from an attorney who had some questions about dual enrollment and what the law says. And we were talking about this particular case that she had just gotten. And what bothered me was the child has a disability. They were in the IEP meeting or the meeting with the school and everything, but he did determine how she might be able to get into a specific program. And I don't know who it was at the school, but in front of the family, they said, we don't think this child will ever be employable.
My goodness.
And that just – I get emotional now. Those are the stories that push me every single day.
Thank you both for sharing that. I really appreciate it. I think it's always nice, especially when we're about to talk about policy issues, large philosophical issues, to be reminded that these are kind of the immediate conversations that are driving all of this. That said, let's talk about money and the state of education funding in Arizona. This seems likely to be a huge issue in the next legislative session. And I want to start by asking you both to put aside questions of political feasibility for a moment and let you both daydream a little bit. Where do you both see money being well spent in the state at the moment? And where would you like to see more money allocated? Carla, let's start with you for this one.
I'm assuming we're talking about K-12 education specifically.
Yes.
Okay. Probably the area that I think we are – that is going well from what we can hear anecdotally and pretty early data are the literacy coaches. And we have not funded at the level that I believe we immediately promised and that other states are doing. And if I could dream, that would be where I would where I would want to increase funding.
Some additional funding to that program, to that program. And just to share the numbers I saw on this most recently were that 30-some percent of third grade students were at a level of reading proficiency.
36%. That's a 3% decline, I might add, though, from last year.
Right. Rebecca, what about you? Pie in the sky.
Well, I definitely agree with Carla that we need to invest in these literacy coaches. And we know from other states that have implemented literacy coaching, you know, Mississippi immediately put 95 literacy coaches in their lowest performing schools. To match that, Arizona would need to put 125 in our lowest performing schools.
Wow.
And currently we have 36. So a big priority for school superintendents next year is to secure at least another $2.1 million for 16 additional coaches to bring that to 50. But that's nowhere near the need of the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the state of Arizona has expanded school choice options, and we have full universal vouchers, a robust charter school system, as well as district schools. And it's becoming very expensive for the state general fund. We're essentially funding three different school systems. And when we talk about academic outcomes, public schools, we are accountable for every dollar we spend and for the academic outcomes of our students. So while these proficiency rates are really low, I think it's important for us to remember that we only have this information and we only truly understand where we should dedicate resources because public schools are accountable for the academic outcomes of their students. Additionally, a judge recently ruled against the state in a school facility lawsuit and essentially said that the way that the state is funding the maintenance and repairs of school buildings is unconstitutional because it guarantees failure. So what that means for your child's school, has your child ever come home from school and complained that the classroom's hot? I mean, there's a good chance in Arizona that in August they're sitting in a classroom that's 84 degrees because before the state will pay to replace that HVAC system, it has to completely fail. The state spends about $200 million a year on maintenance, basic maintenance, roofs, HVACs, things like that. The real need yearly is at least around $600 million.
Wow.
You know, we've built these schools and we need to maintain them. Anybody that owns a house, you understand, you know, you replace your flooring and the infrastructure of your house every 10, 15, 20 years. And so a pie in the sky, perfect world. I'd love to see investments in our lowest performing schools as well as investments in school facilities.
Can I come back to the literacy coaches for just a moment? Because you both brought that up. And for folks who might be listening to this and maybe have heard of the literacy coaching program, but don't necessarily know what that looks like in a concrete way. Who are these coaches? How do they work with students, at least the way the program is currently implemented? Carla, if you want to take that one.
Yeah, I'm sure Rebecca has a lot more details on how it's happening, but I want to clarify one important thing. The coaches aren't necessarily for the kids per se. They're not tutors, if I understand it. They're literacy coaches for the teachers. They're to help supplement, help support, make sure that they're using evidence-based practices.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really important distinction.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so stakeholders in the state, like Arizona school administrators and others who want to see increases in academic performance, are rallying around this Arizona Literacy Plan 2030. So it has a lot of stuff in it in addition to the coaches. It has training requirements for teachers to retrain teachers in the science of reading. It requires districts adopt high-quality, evidence-based instructional materials. But really, the most important part is these literacy coaches. And because of the limited number that we have in Arizona, only 36, right now if you're in the bottom 10% of the test scores on the ELA, you qualify for a literacy coach. And as Carla said, they are there to support the students and the staff. Their role in the school is purely training and intervention in literacy, both with the students and the teachers. They're not allowed to be substitutes or do other duties at the school. They're solely focused on improving the literacy skills of the youngest learners in the school.
We heard at the state board meeting recently, though, that I think the number was still about 25% of districts haven't still adopted evidence-based curriculums as well. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think the literacy plan is amazing. But there's a lot of really basic, what I call the low-hanging fruit,
sure,
that we still need to address.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else is on that list for you?
Curriculum is probably number one.
Curriculum.
The Department of Education has an approved list of curriculum, but they don't have the authority to force them to adopt it. So they'll work with them to encourage it. And there's still about 25% districts that have not adopted curriculums that are on that list. So it's basically the science of reading, that they're aligned with those guidelines.
Yeah, I'd agree with Carla. The other area I think that there's really room for improvement is math, and particularly in the middle grades. In eighth grades, kids tend to fall behind and not learn the skills that they need to be prepared for algebra. And some of that is kind of cultural around this concept of eighth grade. Eighth graders feel like I can kind of do whatever and they're going to move me on to high school. But I think it's similar to literacy in that targeted resources and targeted investments in our lowest performers and helping them learn the basic skills they need to be successful to continue moving forward in math is essential. And I think if I were to, you asked me before, what's pie in the sky, I would look at eighth grade math and making sure our kids are prepared for algebra.
Okay. Okay.
It's a really pivotal time in a kid's career.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you brought that up, I was thinking about just my own mathematical journey, which was a harrowing one. And algebra was the point where it's like math became conceptual and philosophical rather than just raw like inputs and outputs. That reminds me of the way we're talking about literacy, that it's not just about the basic skills. It's also about comprehension.
Mm-hmm. May I add an anecdote?
Sure.
We were at a basketball game, my son's basketball game. I was with my daughter who has Down syndrome, and it was halftime. She wanted a Sprite, and it was time to go back in the gym. And so we're walking, and she stopped. She goes, "Wait, Mom." And she looked. She goes, "Look, no food or drink in the gym." And that moment just hit me that reading is for everybody. She may never get to grade level. Reading comprehension will always be a struggle, but she can get a job. She can go to a restaurant by herself. There are a myriad of things that she can do, even safety-wise,
absolutely,
because she can read those signs. So as much as I am obviously a huge supporter that we get kids to grade level and all that thing, I want to say that it's still, even if they can't, reading is crucial. And it also occurred to me at that moment that it is safety. She can read women and men. She can read all of these signs that she needs to be safe in the community.
That's Carla Phillips-Kravikas and Rebecca Beebe. More of our look ahead at the state of education after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, and we continue now with our look ahead at Arizona education issues in the coming year. Before the break, my co-host Sam Dingman asked Rebecca Beebe and Carla Phillips-Kravikas for their pie-in-the-sky hopes and dreams for changes they'd like to see in schools. In the next phase of their conversation, things get a bit more practical.
Let's end the utopian portion of our conversation now and talk just briefly about the nuts and bolts of what you both imagine the next legislative session might look like from an education standpoint. You both have lots of experience working in gubernatorial administrations at the legislature. Governor Hobbs and her administration are in office at least through the end of next year. So do you think we are likely, based on where things stand, to see significant movement on any of the issues that we've talked about so far today next year? Rebecca, I'll start with you for this one.
Should I make a joke about a crystal ball? I feel like that's what people always say when they're asked that question. I think the biggest issue that's going to be facing policymakers and advocates like, you know, myself, professional advocates or non-professional advocates, parents, whatever, that are watching the legislature, is going to be the budget. We don't have a lot of money, and a lot of the items that we rely on for, as I mentioned, facilities, but also for day-to-day maintenance and operation of a district – are one-time dollars that the state has been spending one time because of budget constraints. They've been kind of kicking the can down the road. Now we're at the end of the road. We can't kick the can any farther. And we don't have the money for these one-time things. And, you know, what the state legislative budget office has said is that we have $67 million to spend. As I mentioned before, we need schools have become reliant on at least $200 million being appropriated for school maintenance. So for basic things, for basic school maintenance, it'll be a battle to get that money. You know, for that's not as interesting to talk about, but teachers and students need good, solid classrooms and school buildings to work and learn in. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what we'll see movement on, but I certainly hope, you know, my message will be every single year we have to continue investing in our students, every single year. Literacy coaches, they're not that expensive. You know, to put another 16 in our classrooms, it would only cost the state $2.1 million. And that's a drop in the bucket.
Carla, how about you, crystal ball?
I just want to come back to one thing you said because I had a flashback of a former school facilities board director many years ago. His joke at the Capitol used to be that roofs didn't have lobbyists. And he's right, right? So when you think about those competing priorities of a reading interventionist and a roof, the roof doesn't have a lobbyist. So I just had to kind of share that little story.
Cute.
But it's true. And it's got a lot of policy implications.
Before we move on to the sort of like high-level philosophical part of this conversation, I wanted to ask you both – Carla, I saw something in one of the pieces I was looking at that you wrote that I was not aware of about how the education system works in Arizona. You were pointing out that, if I'm not mistaken, unlike a lot of other states, a lot of the folks who – the major stakeholders in education policy don't report directly to the governor.
I wrote that somewhere.
And that is in contrast to the way education and the executive office interact in other states. Since you have both worked in gubernatorial administrations, I'm just curious if either of you have any stories about that that you could share that just kind of help illustrate for people what it's like to try to get policy done.
We could spend an hour on this. I have lots of anecdotal stories on this.
Sure.
I remember when Governor Bush was visiting Arizona early on when we were in discussions to adopt the Move On When Reading and letter grades and some other issues. And we all know Florida's a lot bigger than us people-wise. And we would be in these meetings and he was like, yeah, well, I brought all the superintendents up to Tallahassee. And we were looking at each other like, we can't even fathom that because we have so many districts and charter schools and stuff. So even that one thing used to just blow our mind. They only have 67 districts. Mm-hmm. He could bring them all up to Tallahassee and have a conversation, and we can't do that. Mm-hmm. In other states, that the superintendent is like in the governor's cabinet.
I appreciate the concreteness of that example you just gave, just the simple act of calling a meeting.
Yeah.
that's very illustrative. Rebecca, what about you? Any stories come to mind?
I don't know that any stories come to mind, but I certainly don't envy Governor Hobbs or her staff right now. It's got to be incredibly hard to look at this budget. Obviously, she has been public about her concerns with vouchers. It's where a lot of the budget's going. We have a majority Republican legislature and a Democratic governor with two completely different education priorities. And it is interesting, too, that because we have a, you know, independently elected superintendent of public instruction, that individual is always operating on their own too, right? Not as part of the governor's cabinet,
right,
not as part of the legislative body.
Uh-huh.
So I always tell people, you know, we have three people really that we're lobbying, education advocates. And, you know, your question was specifically about the governor, but really anyone that has to be in the room making the hard decisions on this budget,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be impossible.
Well, and we should also add it's also an election year, right?
Yes.
So that's going to complicate things.
Exactly.
Even further.
Yeah.
It's always hard. But to a certain extent, there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
I remember when I got there, it was 24 hours notice because Governor Napolitano left to go to D.C. And Jan Brewer, Secretary of State Brewer, became governor overnight. I was there 24 hours later. We were in the eighth special session of the Great Recession, making cuts that we were literally crying over that. I mean, we were cut $1 billion out of that budget. So those are hard decisions. But I will tell you politically, I was on legislative staff when we had money to spend. And politically, I would argue that's harder.
Sure. Sure. Because it seems in that moment like everything's possible, right?
Yep.
Yeah. There's less of a sense that choices need to be made.
I think one of the things, and I would welcome Rebecca's thoughts on this, that makes this one particularly difficult is the still kind of uncertainty of how HR1 is going to affect our budget, the Medicaid cuts. And so I think that makes it even harder because it's like there's this big cloud out there and it's coming really slow. We don't know when it's going to come. We don't know what it's going to look like, but we know it's going to be big.
Yeah.
I don't envy those people either. You know, the agencies are part of the governor's cabinet. And so the Medicaid agency here is Access and the Department of Economic Security is, you know, to my understanding, getting ready to implement provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that will be very costly to the state. And I like that Carla mentions, you know, that when she was staffing the governor, these are things that made staffers cry. You know, I want to say, I want to just these staffers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats or working for a Republican or a Democrat, I don't think anybody finds joy in trying to balance a budget.
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning just as a side note that the Medicaid debate, if you look at the pie chart that is the state budget, that's the second biggest piece, and that pie keeps getting. So when people ask about why don't we support education, why don't we spend more money, well, the question really is you have a pie, and are you going to take the money from another slice, or are you going to raise taxes and increase revenues? Those are really the two decisions. And so they don't really have the luxury of one bill that says, do you want to increase education? Say yes. It's a huge bill with hundreds of programs. It's a moving part, and Medicaid is the second biggest moving part.
Yeah, I think there's some impacts to Medicaid billing in public schools that we'll see. And so what I also say just with school districts is we serve every kid, including kids that whose families benefit from SNAP and Medicaid. And so we are preparing to see changes maybe to those kids' lives as well.
Last question for you both. This year in particular, and in recent years, we've seen renewed conversation about the role of faith in the classroom. We've seen controversies around the Turning Point chapter at Saguaro High School in Scottsdale. That's just an example, not asking either of you to comment on that situation specifically. There's also obviously been a lot of debate about what constitutes freedom of speech when it comes to protesting, when it comes to writing on social media. How are you each making sense of where that conversation stands at the moment? Rebecca, we'll start with you for this one.
So I remind myself and others that in public schools, the law is that teachers provide a non-sectarian and nonpartisan education. So education free from them sharing their religious beliefs and their political beliefs. And right now, I think in America, everyone's tensions are just a little bit higher.
I think that's fair to say.
And, you know, there was a recent study out of ASU that teachers are nervous to even talk about civics, even though they're talking about them in a nonpartisan way. And it's very important. You know, Governor Ducey, along with retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, several years ago prioritized civics education in classrooms. And now we're at a point where teachers are nervous to talk about civics, talk about the importance of voting. You know, in terms of the Turning Point USA chapters on campuses, what I would say is that a public school, and I've said this many times, but that's where everyone in a community comes together regardless of politics. And in a public high school, kids start student chapters of different clubs. That could be a Gay-Straight Alliance. That could be Turning Point USA. And that is one of the beauties of a public school.
I think I would echo pretty much everything she said. I think it's also important to remember that this is also why we have locally elected governing boards, so that the clubs, the availability of supports really are reflective of the community and the community's needs.
Well, I don't know if we have cracked the future of education, but we've certainly talked about a lot of very fascinating things. I thank you both for your thoughts on this. I have been speaking with Rebecca Beebe, the Director of Government Relations for the Arizona School Administrators, and Carla Phillips-Kravikas, co-founder of Champions for Kids. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the do's, don'ts, and where's of a Chinese Christmas dinner in Phoenix.
For me, the telltale sign of a great Cantonese chef is the use of the wok, how well they control the time and the temperature and get that breath of the wok in the food, wok hei. So I think the main thing is don't take Chinese food to go. You got to eat it there while it's fresh off the wok. You can really taste the difference.
We'll hear one restaurateur's favorite local spots and dishes from dim sum to Peking duck. But first, more than 9 million acres in Arizona are held in trust. When Arizona became a state in 1912, the federal government set aside nearly 11 million acres of state trust land. That land was to be held in perpetual trust, and money raised from the sale or lease of it was to go to 13 beneficiaries, mostly public schools. More than half of the states were granted land to help fund education at statehood. According to a new report, Arizona has by far the most left. And my next guest argues the state can and should be doing more with the land it still has. Glenn Farley is director of policy and research at the Common Sense Institute. He argues the state has failed in its trust management mission and responsibility over the last 100 or so years.
What sets Arizona apart compared to most of these states is the volume of land it received. We received about 2 to 3 times the average state's land trust grant, and how much of that original land trust grant we've retained as physical land today. About 80% to 90% of it remains physical land in the state today, 120 years later.
And in general, this land, from time to time, there are auctions to sell it. The state basically takes the highest bidder. That
Absolutely.
Money gets put into an account that goes to mostly, as you say, public schools, some other beneficiaries in there as well. It sounds as though your group is saying that maybe the state could be doing more with this land.
Right. And so you bring up a good point. We call that the PLEDIF, the Permanent Land Endowment Trust Fund. That's a financial account which holds also in trust on behalf of about the dozen beneficiaries, as you alluded to, most of them the public schools, all permanent revenues derived by these lands. So a sale is a good and easy example of a permanent revenue. We sell the physical land. The proceeds of that get deposited in what we call the PLEDIF. Then the PLEDIF distributes earnings to the beneficiaries. That's relatively unusual among states. But it's useful because now we can compare over time the performance of these two structures. What's interesting about the PLEDIF in particular is it does a lot more with a lot less. Since about the 90s, when it really got started, to today, we've seen its distributions grow at about 8% to 9% per year. I said we have 80% to 90% of the original land still as land. That means the PLEDIF is achieving this growth with just 10% of the asset base. And today it distributes in an average year 3 to 5 times as much to the beneficiaries as the land department distributes using the physical land. So again, to summarize, that was a lot. 10% of the asset base, 3 times the annual distributions. The physical land, 90% of the asset base, 1/3 the annual distribution. So the land yields a lot less for beneficiaries compared to that PLEDIF.
So are you advocating then that the state land department should be more aggressive in selling more land more quickly?
I wouldn't use the term advocating. I think what we're pointing out is, given the historical performance of both the PLEDIF and the land to date, the state clearly could have done much better had it shifted more of the asset base into the PLEDIF much, much sooner.
An investment fund as opposed to
Correct.
Potential money later on.
Correct. And so there's a myriad of possible solutions here. One of the possible solutions that I don't want to just dismiss outright is simply do a better job of managing and taking productive advantage of the physical land. But I think 120 years is a long time and a lot of opportunity to do that. So it is a question, why in 30 years has the state managed to do so much with the financial account, the PLEDIF, and in 120 years, so little with the physical land? That may at this point be an irreconcilable, irresolvable issue, and perhaps it is strictly better, as you said, to sort of shift it entirely into the PLEDIF.
And we should point out that land that is still in the state's possession isn't just sitting there idly in large numbers, right? There are grazing leases, there are mineral leases. Like, the state still is earning some amount of money from land that it still owns, right?
Yeah, no, that is fair. I mentioned that the state distributes about 1/3 as much annually, but it's not zero. Depends year to year, varies year to year, but let's say $75 or $100 million is the value of the annual distributions from that land. Most of the land use, according to data released by the land department, is exactly what you said. Grazing rights, or what they would call sort of miscellaneous open access rights, which mm-hmm. effectively is like traversing the land with animals or people and grazing it as you do so and stuff like that. But how much is actually being used for that on a given day in terms of actual acreage? Tough for me to say. Is it millions of acres? Probably not. I think most of it, most of the time, is in fact sitting idle, and the revenues bear that out.
One of the things that your report points out is the amount of land that is reasonably close to urban areas, especially here in the Phoenix metro area.
Absolutely.
And you point out that, you know, we have a housing shortage. We have this land where houses could be built. It would maybe make sense to use some of that land to build houses. I'm curious how you see the balance of selling land and getting that one-time money into the fund, which of course will continue to generate money because it's an investment fund. But obviously, once you sell that land, it's gone. And if, for example, land prices double in the next 3 years and you've already sold the land, you're out of luck.
No, yes. And I think you just got to what I think is the cause of this issue, which is that concern of what could happen and the foregone or opportunity cost of choosing to sell that land. The result, though, of that has been effective paralysis, and the state has gotten nothing for that original investment or bequeathment that it was given by the federal government 120 years ago. But you also made another point that I want to also touch on, which is, as we point out in the report, it is not true, as many folks believe, that all of this land is in the middle of nowhere. That's part of the problem, is there is a belief out there amongst policymakers and Arizonans that, yeah, okay, there's a lot of land, but it's in the middle of the desert and it's effectively worthless to us. As we point out in the report, a significant amount of it is within 5 or 10 miles of a city. And we specifically limit our analysis, our productive analysis, the potential economic return from this land, to just those parcels that are close to a city and potentially developable. But circling back to your core question, is that a risk? Yes. But the nice thing about the existence of both the financial fund, the PLEDIF, particularly since the 90s, and the land itself for the 120 years, is we don't have to speculate too much on a forward-looking basis. We can just look backwards. What actually happened? What has the state actually gotten for its conservative retention of all this land in terms of returns to beneficiaries? And the answer is very, very little. And compare that to what the state has actually gotten, not hypotheticals, not speculation, what the state has actually managed to do with what little it has sold and deposited in the PLEDIF and distributions from the PLEDIF. And the answer is a whole lot more with a whole lot less.
So it sounds like you're saying, yes, there is a risk, but it's a risk worth taking in this case.
Precisely, 100%.
Legislative Republicans have been critical recently of the Hobbs administration over their approach to state trust land and, you know, the amount of money, especially on leases that the administration is bringing in. Do you think that this is going to be something that lawmakers are discussing in their upcoming session?
I think yes. I think at this point, between this report, the sunset review of the land department, what you alluded to, which is, you know, ongoing and increasingly vocal commentary from the members, and just general interest in finding a revenue source given the struggles the general fund is likely to have over the next couple of years, all of that is going to combine to mean that folks will be looking at and talking about this, yes. And while I think there is some fairness to the perspective of criticizing recent actions by the Hobbs administration, one crux of this report is this is not an administrative problem. This is not a Hobbs administration problem. This is a 100-year problem. No administration in this state has really taken full advantage of this asset. So I think this is something that requires sort of a foundational reevaluation of what our timeline looks like and what our priorities look like. Instead of thinking on a 4 to 8 year schedule, which our reform doesn't posit magically changing the state's fiscal condition in 4 to 8 years, right? We sell the land over a period of 10 years, and then we allow that sale, that pot of money, to appreciate over a period of 20 to 50 years, right? So it's a completely different timeline than we're used to thinking. Is this a solution to the problems for the fiscal 27 or 28 budget? Probably not.
All right. That is Glenn Farley, Director of Policy and Research at the Common Sense Institute. Glenn, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the time.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Lots of Arizonans will be sitting down to home-cooked family dinners on Christmas. But for those who are not, some number of them will be eating Chinese food. History.com traces the tradition of eating Chinese food on Christmas to Jewish immigrants on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the late 1800s. But today, restaurants welcome all kinds of diners and takeout customers. With me to talk more about this and offer a few recommendations is Helen Young, co-owner and chef at Sweet Republic Artisan Ice Cream. And Helen, do you have particular go-to restaurants depending on which style of Chinese food you're interested in?
Sure. I'm from Hong Kong, and so my region is Cantonese food. So dim sum is something that as a family we did when I was a kid. We went to every Sunday. So that's kind of in my blood to want to do that every Sunday. I liked going to Mekong Palace in Mesa for that. Another great place is Great Wall, but it's a little out of further for me, so I tend not to go there as often. And if I'm not doing dim sum, just for some regular meals, I like to go to How How in Scottsdale. That's not too far from me. And it's run by longtime owners of Ni Hao, who retired and then got really bored at home and decided that they want to get back out and cook again. And they cook amazing food. And you know who's cooking it. It's always it's a husband and wife team. So the wife's up front, the husband's in the kitchen, and he's a great chef. And for me, the telltale sign of a great Cantonese chef is the use of the wok, how well they control the time and the temperature and get that breath of the wok in the food, wok hay. So I think the main thing is don't take Chinese food to go. You got to eat it there while it's fresh off the wok. You can really taste the difference.
Huh. So that brings up the question then, if you are going to go, let's say Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, as a lot of people do, you probably have to start planning that now, right?
I don't know how many of them take reservations. I would definitely be prepared to wait and go early and not go during the peak hours of, I don't know what the peak hours are on Christmas, probably every hour is the peak hour.
Yeah.
I try not to go out to eat Chinese food on Christmas. I avoid doing it on that day. But being next to Jade Palace, where our original Sweet Republic is located, they have like multi-hour waits every year since we've been open the last 18 years. I can see crowds of people just waiting 2, 3, 4 hours to go eat there.
Wow. Why do you think it is that Christmas and Chinese food have become so synonymous with each other?
I think because it's open, it's available.
Fair.
I don't know if it's a chicken or egg situation. Is it available open because there's the demand for it, or, you know, which came first? But, you know, Chinese restaurants are famous for being open all the time. There are some incredibly hardworking people. And Chinese food is one of the best foods in the world. I mean, I might be a little biased. It's affordable too, amazing value. There's always something for everybody. And it's great to bring a family. You're not going to spend a ton of money, but you're going to, you know, have a good time, have some leftovers to bring home. Kind of what's not to love.
Yeah. Well, so do you have sort of a go-to? I know you don't really go on Christmas because you're trying to avoid the crowds, but like this time of year, do you have a favorite dish that you might order that maybe is different from what you'd eat in, you know, let's say June or July?
So I like to splurge on some fresh seafood out of the tank. And you can get that at Great Wall or Mekong Palace, the bigger restaurants. And you can look in the tank, kind of point at the fish or the crab or the lobster that looks good to you and watch them fish it out of the tank and cook it however you like. You can have it deep fried with salt and pepper, or you can have it steamed, which is my preferred way, with ginger and green onion. And it's like you can taste it, the ocean in the food. It's so fresh. And a tip is get it on crispy noodles so that soaks up all the gravy and sauce that seeps down from the, especially the ginger or green onion sauce. It's so good.
Ah, so I've got to ask you about Peking duck, which of course is famous from A Christmas Story. Is this one that you hear from people that they try to maybe another splurge around Christmas?
For sure. I think Peking duck is a splurge for me too. I think for Chinese people, it's equally a splurge because you have this whole duck that's brought to the table and then they shave off just that crispy skin and then you eat it with the hot pancakes or warm steamed buns and you put that hoisin sauce on it and some slivered green onions. It's just as good as it gets, that the crispy skin with, you know, the fat almost rendered off. That's an amazing dish. But I have to say, I sometimes prefer roast duck. Roast duck, you have like the meat is more moist. For Peking duck, they have to cook it longer to render off more fat and get that skin super crispy. But where roast duck, you get like the marinated tender meat and still a semi-crispy skin. And it's also cheaper too. And it doesn't usually take the extra time. Some restaurant asks like, you know, maybe an extra 30 minutes, or they also charge you more money for it. They're both really good. Depends on what you're looking for.
Have you ever been tempted, and I apologize if you've actually done this and I'm just not aware of it, have you ever been tempted to take some of the dishes that you really like at Chinese restaurants and turn them into ice cream flavors?
No. That's an interesting question.
Like, I'm not sure how a Peking duck ice cream would go, but it might be interesting.
I mean, the closest thing we have done is do a Sichuan orange chocolate that was actually even in Time magazine. You know, the Sichuan peppercorns that give you kind of tingling feeling on your tongue. We put that in with the chocolate ice cream and I think a little bit of orange zest. And we haven't done that recently. Reminds me, I should probably do it again. It was delicious.
All right. That is Helen Young, co-owner and chef of Sweet Republic. Helen, thanks so much. Thanks for making me so hungry. I appreciate that. Happy holidays. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was a pleasure.
I eat Chinese food on Christmas. Go to the movie theater too. 'Cause there just ain't much else to do on Christmas. When you're a Jew.
Today we wrap up this year's collection of Eating Christmas essays at a fancy steakhouse on Christmas Eve. As KJZZ contributor Robert Pala explained, sometimes fancy, though, can leave a bad taste in your mouth.
It's Christmas Eve, and a woman I don't know has just placed a tiny bowl of mushrooms in front of me. This itty-bitty appetizer costs more than the hand-knit vicuña cardigan I'm wearing. I've eaten expensive food before, but what I haven't done is dine in a restaurant on Christmas Eve. I'm sitting in this snooty supper club, and I'm not feeling grateful that I get to spend the holidays with the nicest man in the world to whom I happen to be married. No, what I'm doing instead is thinking about how someone should really write a song about the first Christmas you spend away from your family. I mean, we have a holiday song about finding a hippopotamus in your Christmas stocking, for Christ's sake. And one about someone's grandmother being run over by a reindeer. But we don't have one that describes what it's like to be 45 years old and passing the holiday in an over-decorated chain restaurant, surrounded by strangers, clutching your husband's hand, as if you're about to be wheeled in for an emergency gallbladder surgery instead of waiting for a piece of balsamic glazed monkfish to be brought to your table. I'm thinking that the lyrics to this Christmas song should be vague so that people who've been deployed to Iraq or recently divorced or whose boss is making them work on Christmas can relate to it too. And not just, say, someone who's divorced his entire family right before the holidays. That's too specific and not very Christmassy. The first stanza could be one in which a grown-up person who bought into that whole family is everything suddenly finds himself doing something different on Christmas Eve. Nothing too whiny, though. The second verse could be about how the subject's husband has suggested they spend their first Christmas Eve alone in a fancy restaurant eating monkfish and mushrooms. Really expensive mushrooms. I'm thinking about how in the chorus it might become plain that the husband thinks eating in a restaurant on Christmas Eve will distract the person who's no longer speaking to his family from feeling sad about it. I'm sitting there eating mushrooms and trying to figure out if the bridge of this song should be instrumental and where a modulation might occur, maybe from G major to A flat major for a nice gospel-like surge. When my monkfish arrives and my husband looks at it and says, "Well, looks nice," and I smile and try to think of something brave to say. Just then, a woman at the next table slams her fork onto a plate full of puttanesca and announces, "Damn it, Norman!" The man seated across from her, perhaps this is Norman, glances over at our table. He looks uncomfortable. "I told you not to mention Dad tonight," the woman bellows, glaring at the man who is obviously Norman. "But it's Christmas, Bettina," he begins, and the woman with the puttanesca, whose name appears to be Bettina, leaps from her chair and storms out of the restaurant. I try to catch Norman's eye. I want to say to him, "Maybe you should divorce your family, too." But he's not looking our way, too busy telling the four others at his table what exactly he thinks of them and of Bettina. None of his comments contain much of what you'd call Yuletide cheer. Unable to get Norman's attention, I turn instead to my husband. Merry Christmas, dear, I say to him. Next year, let's stay home, just the two of us.
That was KJZZ contributor Robert Paleb. You can, of course, find more Eating Christmas essays at kjzz.org. And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow.